Welcome to the EY CEO Outlook podcast series, where our host Richard Curran talks to some of Ireland's leading CEOs about leadership, lessons learned, and their future business plans. Hi, I'm Graham Reid, partner and head of markets here at EY. In this episode, we welcome Deborah Kelleher, CEO of RYAM, the Royal Irish Academy of Music. RYAM is Ireland's oldest conservatoire, training musicians from all over the world for careers in music performance, composition, and teaching. With the launch of their 175 strategic plan in 2021, RYAM has identified key areas of continued success, including further investment in access and inclusion, as well as developing a new organisational model. Let's hear more on this from Deborah. Over to you, Richard.
Thanks, Graham, and we hope you are enjoying this podcast series of interviews with CEOs, and thanks for listening to the EY Podcast CEO Outlook series. If you like what you've heard, hit follow or subscribe and leave a review. And do subscribe because we have lots more big interviews with industry leaders in the weeks ahead. My next guest on this episode is Deborah Kelleher, Chief Executive of the Royal Irish Academy of Music. Deborah became CEO in 2010, a difficult time in Ireland to take over any organisation, but she has reshaped the organisation, its relationships with other educational institutions, and more recently, its building. Deborah, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Richard.
We can talk about the challenges and successes of the last 12 years and into the future at the Royal Irish Academy, but first, tell me about your own relationship with music. It was piano for you.
It was piano for me, yes. I started piano at the age of 7 and I went to the College of Music, and I was a very obedient kind of child and I had very good teachers. So if they told me to practice, I practiced. And I developed then, you know, I became quite good by the age of 12 and very good by 13, 14, 15, 16. So it was really a life devoted to piano in my school years. And I was lucky that my mother, Deirdre, was an Irish harpist. She used to play the harp with Mary O'Hara and Kathleen Watkins in a trio. So she loved the music. So she supported me and brought me into my lessons, which is a huge thing for music. Your parent has to be available and supportive in that way. And it became my thing then as a young person.
Piano is very difficult, though. It's not easy to learn. And piano teachers and lessons, there is a sort of a perception out there that it's a fairly tough environment to be in.
Music as a hobby is not easy. It's not like pottery or painting where there can be a relaxation about it. For music, you have to concentrate. You have to practice regularly. You have one-to-one lessons, which means every week you're going to be criticised. You have to respond to criticism. You have, you know, exams or competitions or performances, which means you have to set yourself goals and perform at those goals. Now, that's the tough part. If you think about it educationally, what children get out of those skills, it's absolutely immense. It's why music is one of the most highly rated educational things outside from the regular STEM. But then I haven't talked about the creativity, the love of pieces. Playing as a child where you block everything else out because all you can do is play the piano, and the wonder and the beauty of that, and also the pals that you make, the friends that you make in orchestra or when you go into a theory class. So though it is a challenge, the rewards are immense.
For you then, while you were practicing, how often would you have practiced as a child?
I was very serious about the piano. So from about the age of 12, I was practicing at least 2 hours a day. By the time I was 16, 17, that was up to 5 hours a day. So I was cycling on my Triumph 20 over to the nuns in Loretto and Rathfarnham because they had a Bluthner grand piano. And then I was at it again. And then I also had my schoolwork. I mean, I didn't go to the Gaeltacht. I didn't go to school tours because I wouldn't miss my piano lessons. If you take it at that level where you're effectively pre-professional, then there's not a lot of room for other things if you're a serious young musician.
And throughout your teens then, as the practice would have ramped up, your abilities, everything was getting better and getting stronger. Was that for you? Did you feel, I want to be a piano soloist, I want to be a professional musician, that's the career?
Honestly, yes. I became so immersed in the music and the life that I couldn't imagine doing anything else. So when I went to CAO time and I had to fill in my CAO, I only put in two things. I put in music, line one, in Trinity, and I put in music and English line two in Trinity, and then I left it. Because at that time, my teacher certainly regarded Trinity College as the number one place for music students to go. It was that serious, Richard. There wasn't any question in my mind other that music would be my life.
Were you someone who would question yourself about your own abilities? Because when you want to go into such a high profile, but such a perfectionist environment, you know, you've got to be the best, you've got to be so good and reach such a standard. Would you ever say, am I good enough? I'm not sure I'm good enough. Would you ever question that?
Oh, yes. Because when I say I wanted to go into music, my intention wasn't to be a concert pianist. It was to be in a wider sense, because a musician can be a teacher. It can be a performer. It could be an administrator. It could be a journalist. It could be anything. It was music that was inspiring me. Was I tough on myself? Absolutely, because I had a very demanding teacher, and music at a very, very high level is demanding. So I remember nights before piano competitions, for instance, lying in my bed thinking, this piece of music, it almost feels like a car, and I've taken every part out of the car and polished it, but the car isn't back together. How am I going to play tomorrow? Literally. But then you go on the stage and it comes together and you play the piece and you have a moment of magic and it's all worthwhile.
Would you describe yourself as a solitary person? Do you need to have that in order to do what you did?
I think piano playing is something quite extraordinary, because I would say I'm a solitary person. I mean, the sacrifice, you know, it's a personal thing. This wouldn't be for everybody, but I don't still have friends from school because I wasn't cultivating that group. I was practicing. I practiced on my own so much as a pianist that it wasn't natural to me to socialise. So I would still be very close to my family, but I wouldn't have a particular large social group. Now, that said, I am very close and very fond of my work colleagues and my wider colleagues in music, because that's my tribe. So it's not that I don't have friendships or I don't have a social outlet. It's just so intimately connected to my profession that maybe that's a little bit different.
So you studied music. At some point, you stayed in music, obviously, and you're steeped in it, but it took a different direction for you.
Yeah, I mean, when I got to college and I got to Trinity, it was academic music. And I was still playing. But to be honest with you, Richard, I think as a solo pianist, I peaked in my school years. I was probably the best of my age around 17 when I was doing my Leaving Cert. But when I went into Trinity, I started to see people who were also really good at music. So I was a good level and I was a good academic. But I felt I was a jack of all trades, master of none. So that kind of bothered me. And I went on and I did a master's in musicology. So I went further into academics and I became a very good accompanist for singers or for instrumentalists. And that was very, very enjoyable. And I could have specialised in any of those, but I didn't put myself through that. So always bothering me, I wanted to excel. I've always wanted to excel. And then at one point, I decided to do an MBA, a Master in Business Administration, because I felt I have a lot of very, very good skills. And it could be that these are actually better bundled together as a manager and a leader, so that I had the industry knowledge, I had the understanding of what music was, but maybe my role was on a different platform. And actually, I never looked back after the MBA. That was a real game changer for me.
When you combine your musical experiences with the MBA and what you would have learned there, what did you bring from the musical experience? I mean, I would imagine discipline in order to reach the level that you did in piano. You know, the days you don't want to practice, the day you don't want to do this, you just do it. Was that one of the things? What other things did you bring from it?
I went into the MBA completely clueless. So, you know, corporate finance, accounting, organisational behaviour, marketing, business strategy. I'd never done any of these. I mean, I remember in one of my first lectures, someone was talking about HP and how, you know, how they were developing. I literally said to myself, God, for brown sauce, they're doing really well. I mean, I hadn't even connected that it was Hewlett Packard. Like, we're talking that level. But I'm a quick learner, and that's what musicians are. I can think laterally. I can think very creatively, because musicians bring together an awful lot of skills. So what I found was, by the end of first year, I was first in my class in my MBA, in a pretty ambitious class, because I was able to assimilate knowledge and put it together and find something new and different from the standard answers. And I think that's what musicians bring in a different thing. It's that ability to synthesize complex things, and creativity and problem solving is almost our number one and two skills. And you can imagine how useful they are in industry. So that was an extraordinary revelation to me. It was like a reverse hobby. I became obsessed by the creativity of the business world because I'd had creativity for 30 years in music. So the transition to me was really quite natural.
So after the MBA, management, you honed all of those skills and you arrive in this a CEO of the Royal Irish Academy of Music. It's 2010. The country is up in a heap. It's as if nobody's got any money and you would have had a baptism of fire.
It was. I mean, I came into the job. I was 37. My son was 3 months old and I had a plan. And the plan nearly went out the window because you were at that point in the recession where it was at its worst almost. And the first job I had to do was cut 18% of staff. And we couldn't have involuntary redundancies. So there was a call on us to do almost the impossible. And you were also in a situation where this was not going to be good for staff morale, who had already lived through the uncertainty of this. So we had to formulate a plan. We had to have town hall meetings with staff. We had to meet staff one-to-one to explain to them that their hours would be reduced or that we were putting them on a transfer list to go to another department.
How did you find that experience?
I had a wonderful finance officer at the time, Dorothy Scheel, and she was very experienced. It was a combination of things. It was distressing to have to give bad news to staff. It was a very challenging time because, of course, they didn't want these changes and they would have had maybe alternative ideas. So we had to kind of hold to a line. But at the time, you also are, you know, well, this isn't a choice. This has been visited upon us. And my job was to deliver what the government needed me to deliver. So you kind of are grounded in the sense of purpose that you have.
So when you dealt with that and as you were dealing with that, you also had to have an eye to the future. And the funding model for the Academy, fundraising is a big part of it. Very hard to fundraise 2010, 2011, 2012.
Yeah. At that point, it was about stabilising the business. So we had tuition income, we had exam fees, and we had government subsidy. The government subsidy clearly wasn't going to be going many places. So we had to check that our tuition would be strong, and it's still strong. We still have 10 times as many applicants for places in the academy, and that didn't change. Our exam candidates still want to do exams, so that was stable. So there was an opportunity to grow donors, and I brought in my head of development, Audrey Phelan, and she started to develop financial aid packages. So we've, to this day, we give about 5% of our budget to financial aid. So that started at that time because it was needed. But the other thing we did...
That's for students who are in need of help.
Yes. I mean, even this morning, I had a meeting with a couple who are probably going to come on board for students from DESH schools to do strings, free string tuition, violin and viola. So it's for families in financial need to continue going, and gave it to our families who were with us in the academy at the time as well. But the other thing, Richard, that we worked on was we became an Associate College of Trinity in that time. So that's a zero cost, but that's about prestige. It's about developing the curriculum.
What does that mean? It means you work jointly together and you have a formal connection or association.
Yeah, we signed a formal MOU in 2014. So Trinity accredits our degree. So if you come into the academy, you will graduate with a Trinity thing in the Trinity exam hall. They quality assure us, which means that we have committees that we attend and we say, OK, this is what's happening with our programmes. But they also help us to promote the academy internationally. And we have had an uplift in tertiary applications since becoming an associate college because of the Trinity brand. It's so strong internationally. So it's been very strong for us.
So having negotiated that and sorted all that, you could see pretty quickly application levels, student levels going up.
We started to see that. And that was 2014. And then when I looked around at the academy and I thought, OK, what are the SWOT analysis? Our strengths were our staff. We also had a strength and an opportunity in the Trinity connection. We had our threat was going to be always our financial model. And a weakness was our building. So we had a Rolls-Royce staff and extraordinarily successful students. we were like a Rolls-Royce trapped in the body of a mini metro, because our building on Westland Row, beautiful though it is, was too small for us. And there were some really pokey rooms. It was just not fit for purpose. So it was at that point that the governors made the decision that we were going to do a pretty big campus transformation. That conversation started in 2015, and it's ending now when we open the building in September of this year, in a couple of months.
And part of that involved patrons and donations, some of them very well-known people. Bill Whelan from Riverdance was one.
Bill Whelan, it's been extraordinary. You know, now remember, this is 2015 onwards, so we're starting to come out. There's a bit of optimism here. We had a plan. We got planning permission. So Bill Whelan was one of the first that came in, and it's extraordinary for that musician, that innovator, to come on board. Moya Doherty has also supported us. And then you have leaders of industry like Lachlan Quinn, like Martin
Former
and Carmel
Glenn
Nocton.
Dimplex.
That's right.
The Noctons of
Glenn Dimplex. And Stephen Vernon of Green Reet. And then we had a fairly significant proportion. I mean, to put it in perspective, this is a 25 million build. We've got 10 million from the Irish government, and we've got over 11 million from donors, and the rest is from the Academy's funds. Out of those donors, a fair proportion is also American. So that was leveraged largely through the Ireland funds.
And I was going to ask you about that, a snapshot of the business end of things today. You know, how many students you have, what are they studying, and from what age is up? And are many of them, you know, from outside of Ireland, for example?
Our breadth is extraordinary. You can start at age 2 with ditties for dotes, and then go into pre-instrumental from age 4, which is group violin or group recorder. And then you go through your primary and your secondary school years, 1-to-1. And then we have bachelor, master's and doctorate degrees. So you could really come in at age 2 and come out at age 29 with a doctorate degree from the Academy. And actually, at the end of this month, we're launching a adult division, which means that you can be, you know, over 21 and a returner to music or learning some music appreciation. So it's cradle to grave, because music is cradle to grave. That's the model.
See, Deborah, you have a problem here now with me, because I've never studied music, but I've seen the film Whiplash, where the guy is a jazz drummer, very elite, very high end. And the stress that he goes through, that he puts himself under as well as what he receives. I don't know if you've seen the film. Is that in any way representative of how the world of music education is at that top level?
That's a really good question. And I would describe the likes of Whiplash, which is an extraordinary film. I recognise elements of it, but I would describe it more like old school education, because that certainly, the model of master-apprentice is what music was built on. I am the master. You will sit at my feet and I will teach you, and you will be like a vessel into which I will pour my knowledge. But modern education is much more student-centred. It celebrates the fact that we are all unique and that we have our own approach and our own creativity. And it also acknowledges that that ultimately may be more successful than just being a recording device for someone else's ideas. If you think about it this way, Richard, we now live in the recording age. Now, when the master-apprentice model was invented, there were no records, there was no radio. So it was probably vitally important that you just replicated what your master did. That ain't so anymore. Actually, what we're about in music is different.
And in musical education, and particularly those who want to pursue very high standards, do you have to be aware of the psychology and the psychological pressures and how people want to measure themselves against others or their own benchmarks of success?
I think music education is learning a lot from sports education. And one of the most exciting things I ever knew about sports education is this idea of achieving your personal best. So I was a competitive youngster, and it nearly did for me in college, because I thought, oh God, everybody's really good now. You know, what am I if I'm not the best in my class? And my father, who was a complete non-musician, said, don't think laterally. And that really changed things for me. I wanted to be the best musician I could be. And that's what we try and say to our students. Yes, there are competitions. Yes, there are exams, because setting milestones and goals helps you grow. But it's not all about that. In music, it's even easier than sport in a way, because in sport, there's a winner and a loser. Your interpretation of a piece is your interpretation, and you own it, and no one else does. Someone might like it, someone might not, but that's okay. It's all personal.
When it comes to classical music, the perception that it's highbrow, elitist. It was interesting you talked about the 5% that you use to help people, students who need a financial leg up and DESH schools. Is that changing?
I think classical music, it did itself no favours about 100 years ago when classical music composers stopped writing for an audience. And they thought, well, you don't like how I write, so I'm just going to think this is for posterity. And that gave a kind of a sense that it wasn't for everybody. Up until then, people loved classical music, is all they did. And that you had the rise of popular and commercial music, and classical music became a bit sidetracked. My view is that classical music is one type of music. It's not better or worse. It's just a type of music. And if you love that music, you love it and it's great. It has some very good foundation building blocks for other types of music. You know, Paul McCartney listened to a lot of classical music. It absorbed into his style. So I would always urge people to give classical music a go as a performer, as a student, as a listener.
The elitist kind of thing, the Scottish comedian Billy Connolly had this gag where he said, what's the definition of an intellectual? It's someone who can listen to the William Tell overture without thinking of the Lone Ranger. And there is an element of that, isn't there, about it? I mean, I remember when Pavarotti died, there was a cartoon, a newspaper cartoon of a very well-heeled couple coming out of a theatre. And the newspaper headline said, Pavarotti dies. And the husband says, he was amazing. He really brought opera to the masses. And his wife says, I know, I'll never forgive him for that.
Yeah.
Do you have to combat all of that?
You do. And, you know, there is, you know, there's always been the snobbery around it that, you know, I remember going to a concert and now it's 20 years ago, though, where in the middle of a piece, there was a four movement piece and the audience applauded after the first movement. And one of the members of the string quartet who was performing hissed at the audience to get them to shut up. But that's kind of receding now. I think now the classical music is being rebalanced as not better, but just different. Certainly in the academy, we have staff from all areas of society. You know, our flute teacher grew up in the Fatima Mansions. So for us, there isn't that classist aspect to it. But I definitely know it's a message that has to go out there, that because there is still a perception it's not for people.
What about music for you? Do you still play the piano at home, or do you play it often?
Yeah.
Do you enjoy it?
That's maybe a kind of one, maybe not so great legacy from my childhood, because I don't play the piano for pleasure, because I never played the piano for pleasure. It was more important than that. It was a vocation. So once I stopped playing seriously, which is when I became director, there was no reason for me to sit at the piano. It's not what I enjoy. It's not what I relax to. So sadly, I would say I don't play for pleasure anymore.
What about listening to music? You must understand and know so much about the mechanics of what is inside a piece of music. Who's your favourite composer? Who do you listen to?
I have a weakness. I go for a walk every day and I listen almost 100% only to classical violin concertos. So the Tchaikovsky violin concerto, Brahms, Bruck, Beethoven, because I find them thrilling. And I walk around and I walk around like a dressage horse, like with my knees up in the air, thinking about life and things and decompressing and hearing this just on a loop, thrilling, romantic music. And my heart lifts because I'm looking out at the sea, because I live by the sea. And it's one of my favourite things to do. It's been a lifeline for me throughout the work that I do to have that release. And that's wonderful to have that.
What about the future of the Royal Irish Academy? What you want for it, if you could project, you know, 5 years, 7 years down the road from now, what does success look like from where you are now?
We're on the brink of it. And this was what I would like. In my definition of success is that, first of all, the building is there. It's ready. It's accessible. It's the vehicle. It's now a Rolls Royce. But it's what's inside the vehicle. It's what's inside the building that matters. So what are we working on at the moment? We're working on a revised curricula that is actually about being student-centred. It's about expanding a little bit more than classical so that people can come in and actually learn what they like. And it's about developing creativity and entrepreneurship and thinking more holistically about the person than just giving them violin lessons or piano lessons. About making sure that we're nurturing that person, that artistic soul, and that we're not getting in the way of their well-being and their happiness. So that's the first thing in the curriculum.
So that really broadens it out from a level of competence or ability with an instrument. Do you know what I mean? Yep. That's a much broader personal fulfillment thing.
And how we're doing this is we've stratified our business. We now have our pre-college division, junior RIAM. We have our professional division, which is our bachelor, master's and doctorate degrees. And we have our adult division. Each of those people will have a different motivation and they will learn with a different intensity. Now that we've divided them out very purposefully, we'll set targets about numbers and we'll also set targets about the teachers and the skills and the goals that they will set. So if you don't want to take your music to professional level, but that you want to enjoy your music, then your teacher will know that and there won't be rows every week about why you're not practicing 6 hours a day. So that's the curriculum and it's going through that. And then the other aspect that I want is we've purposely built a very big building. I want to hire more staff because I want to have more students coming in and learning in the academy. And finally, Richard, you know, the academy's gone about its business for the last 175 years quietly. I want people to know about the Academy of Music more. I want them to feel that it's a place for them, because if there are more students and there are more opportunities to come, I want the people of Ireland to feel that this is a place that's actually a home for them. And that's a big job to do.
We ask all of our guests on this podcast a few questions, or the same questions for all guests. It's like a bit of a quick fire round, Deborah, and I'll throw them at you now. What CEO or entrepreneur do you most admire and why?
There are two on this one. The first one is Stephen Vernon, because I feel he is almost musician-like in the decisions he made. You know, he was Green Property, then he went Green REIT, purchasing Blanchardstown, selling Blanchardstown. Now, he has been a significant donor in the Academy, but actually the day he sold Blanchardstown, he was at a concert and having pizza with us the night before, and he was saying, I think I'm selling something. And the glamour of that was exciting. But his timing is extraordinary. The other CEO I admire is Linda Doyle, who's the Provost of Trinity, because she also has to make tough decisions. She's very natural. She's very intelligent. And I'm excited about Trinity under her leadership.
Your favourite book or film? I've already asked you about music. What about book or film?
Yeah, I was thinking about this. I think my favourite film has to be Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel, because I love the audacity of the general manager, who's the Ralph Fiennes character. I adore it. My favourite book, to be honest with you, there's a book that was written by a man called Napoleon Hill in the 1930s. And it has the unedifying title, Think and Grow Rich. And actually, Napoleon Hill was a charlatan that was discredited. But he actually had a way of visualising that probably is the most significant thing that got me my success in fundraising. Because I used to go out when I was listening to my Tchaikovsky, I would shout at the sea every day, and I still do, what I want and how I'm going to get it and what the world will get in exchange for what I want. And that was
in the book.
It was in that book.
Wow, interesting. Your personal mantra in business?
My personal mantra is positive and purposeful. They are honestly the two words that I would use most often in key meetings, either with staff or with donors, because I'm a very forward-looking individual. And I don't like to admire a problem. I like to understand the problem and then I like to move forward. So they are the ones. And, you know, I heard Matt Williams once say, mindset drives performance. And that's another one. I feel you can talk yourself out of something and talk yourself into it. And I'd rather talk myself into something.
When you're finished this job at some point in the future, what would you like people to say about what you achieved and how you did it?
I would like to be known as a leader who allowed people to do their best in their jobs. And I would like to be known as someone who acted with kindness, because I think that is critically important. What would I like them to achieve? I'd like them, you know, if they were being very straight, I'd like them to know that the academy curriculum reformed, that the building was right for the people, and that we increased our staff and students so that there was more music for more people.
What advice would you give someone who is just at the beginning of running a business or an organization? Some piece of advice that you think from your experience they might find helpful?
I would say try and find some mentors or advisors. All along the way, there were very wise individuals that had different experiences, and that would I would talk to them, I would listen to them, and if they gave me advice, I would usually take it. That's the other thing. I think it can be a superpower if someone gives you advice and you actually listen to them and implement it, as long as it's good advice.
Be prepared to take the good advice. Deborah Kelleher, Chief Executive of the Royal Irish Academy, congratulations on the job that you've done at such an important musical institution in Ireland, and good luck with everything in the future. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We hope you are enjoying the EY Podcast CEO Outlook series. Remember, you can catch previous interviews we've done with CEOs like Paul Reid of the HSE, David McRedmond of Unpost, Tony Smurfit of Smurfit Kappa Group, and Anne Herity of CPL. Until the next time, thanks for listening.
EY, building a better working world.